Good evening. You are listening to the Elchar Chronicles. I'm your host, Karen Elchar. This program chronicles issues of law and order and our local justice system, the environment, and Indigenous issues with guests that dig deep into topics less talked about here in the Lehigh Valley. This evening, I'm pleased to welcome two guests, Stephanie Wine, clean water and conservation advocate with Penn Environment Research and Policy Center, and Marilyn Shields, executive director with Pennsylvania Interbranch Commission for Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Fairness. Marilyn, I'd like to begin with you, and thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I have to admit that I hadn't heard of your organization until I read a recent article in one of our local newspapers. So let's start with an overview of the Pennsylvania Interbranch Commission for Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Fairness.
Sure. As with most things that begin in Harrisburg, the Interbranch Commission started with a study. Chief Justice Cappy, he was the Chief Justice at the time, wanted a study about the impact of race, gender, and ethnicity on our justice system. That was his question. He pulled together professionals from across the Commonwealth. So there were lawyers, there were judges, there were community members to study that question. They spent about 4 years doing research, having hearings, talking to people about their experience in the justice system. That group then put together a really robust report, a 500-plus page report with hundreds of recommendations, and they crossed all three branches of our government. So there were recommendations for the executive branch, the judiciary, and the General Assembly. Perhaps the most important recommendation of all the recommendations that body had was to create the Interbranch Commission. They understood at the time that the work of the Interbranch Commission wasn't going to be done in a week or a month or even a year, but that there needed to be a body charged with kind of following these initiatives and perhaps identifying new initiatives over time. So that's how the Pennsylvania Interbranch Commission came into being in 2005. So we actually just celebrated our 20th anniversary on January 1st. We get commissioners from all three branches of government. So 8 of our commissioners come from the governor, 8 come from the Supreme Court, and 8 come from the leaders of the House and Senate, Republican, Democratic leaders.
And so what are the criteria for each of those individuals or those people who sit on the commission? What's the criteria for them to be involved?
It's really up to the bodies that are appointing. We don't set at Interbranch Commission any guidelines. What we suggest, and we have conversations with each of the three entities, we want to make sure we have a broad cross-section of our Commonwealth represented. We don't just want to be an organization with individuals from Allegheny County, Dauphin County, and Philadelphia County. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure we're hearing from people in Erie, from northeastern Pennsylvania. So when we have those conversations, for example, with the governor's office, when a vacancy comes available, we say, hey, this is what we have right now, and we keep a map of our commissioners, and we show them, this is where we are right now. Maybe we need some representation in the center of the state. Can you help us with identifying good candidates, people that are interested in these issues that would be willing to join us? We also have committees, which give us an opportunity to really kind of delve in and look at where we're missing representation and immediately add people to our various committees to make sure we've got a good cross-section of the public. We're not only interested in geographic diversity, which is very important because what's happening in Lehigh County is not what's happening in Lycoming County, but we're also interested in having people from different professional backgrounds on our committees and on our commission. We have a lot of lawyers, we have a lot of judges, but we need to hear from people who are outside of those very specific areas on our committees and commissions.
I'm gathering that you're also opening on the committee level. It's not just the 24 that you'd mentioned initially, but it's also lay people of some sort. So it's not necessarily government individuals.
Correct. Absolutely. We have individuals from all sorts of backgrounds on our committee, some that are specifically focused on, I'll take, for example, our LGBTQ plus rights committee. We really looked at organizations across the Commonwealth that are focused on and have expertise in LGBTQ plus issues and said to them, for example, Corinne Goodwin, who is executive director of Eastern Pennsylvania Transgender Project, went to her and said, hey, would you be willing to be on our LGBT committee? Mm-hmm. And she said yes. And she has been able to come to us, and we've been able to partner with her organization to advance issues here and there. And we look to build those partnerships, yes, with government entities, certainly, but with people that are completely outside of the governmental process as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. And so are your meetings, do you rotate them throughout the Commonwealth, or what do you do with your meetings?
At the commission level, we meet 4 times a year. We have quarterly meetings. Our fall meeting, usually in September, is in Harrisburg. We all come out to Harrisburg for a face-to-face meeting. Our committee meetings, which are bi-monthly, so every other month, are all online. So that gives us flexibility to reach out to Erie County without having to drive out there. It gives us the ability to really open up our committee membership as far as we can.
Mm-hmm. Makes total mm-hmm. sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. In today's environment, yes, doing things online is a bit more convenient.
No one's going to drive all the way to State College for an hour meeting.
No. All right, so how do you get your cases? What kinds of cases do you get?
We don't take cases. So we are unlike an organization, for example, the ACLU of Pennsylvania. They will file lawsuits against the governor or against a court. We don't file any lawsuits. What we do, however, is we identify issues. I mentioned that we have committees. We have, at this point, 6 standing committees. We have a language access committee, a jury service committee, criminal justice committee, LGBTQ plus rights committee, and equal opportunity and diversity committee, and now our domestic violence and sexual assault survivors committee. And each one of those committees is charged with identifying a few issues that they're going to focus on each year. We know there are a plethora of issues that we could be addressing at any given time, but we really push our members to focus on a few issues that we're going to tackle in the calendar year. Our Language Access Committee, for example, is really focused on developing a toolkit. If you show up at a courthouse or you've got an administrative hearing, you have the right, if you need it, to have an interpreter available for your proceeding. If you receive documents from the court, you have the right to have core key documents translated into your language of choice. Not a lot of people know how to avail themselves yeah. of that process. So we're trying to kind of demystify, if we can, that process and make it easy. Okay, I've got a summons. I may need someone to interpret in Spanish. How do I go about making that request? And how do I go about giving feedback about the services that I receive? Because we know at times that the services aren't perhaps being given as intended under the language access plan. So we try to be there to bridge those gaps and A, communicate with the public so that they know what their rights are and how to avail themselves, but then provide that feedback, for example, on language access to the Administrative Office of Pennsylvania Courts, AOPC, about what's working well and what perhaps could use some improvement. So we talk in 2 different ways. Sometimes we're talking with the public about their rights, and sometimes we're talking to agencies and organizations about what we're hearing could be improved and made better for everyone that's mm-hmm. trying to access services.
So how do people find out about you?
Oh, well, I'm here,
yes,
right?
So this is a start.
This is a big part of it. So historically, Interbranch Commission has been very good about communicating with attorneys and judges. Mm-hmm. That's very easy because the prior executive director, she was an attorney. I'm an attorney. There's no shortage of opportunities for me as executive director of this organization to talk to lawyers, to talk to judges. What I think we can do better and what we've been really focused on since I took over this role in August 2023 is talking to the public. That meant for me immediately when I started looking at our website and saying, is this our best way of communicating with the public about what we are and what we do? Can we improve that? And we're in the process of revamping our website right now. We didn't have an Instagram. We didn't have a LinkedIn feed. So we have since developed those. We had a Facebook feed that had been dormant for more than a year. So a lot of our work has been, okay, we talk to professionals all the time. That's well and good. We will keep doing that work. But how do we communicate with the public? What options are available for us to get our message out directly to people? And this is what we've been doing, is really building up, making sure we're communicating in a nice, clear, concise way about all of these issues that we're tackling.
Mm-hmm. And so if someone wanted to reach out to you at this point, what would be the best avenue to do so?
Well, you can always email me. It's very easy. It's my name, marilyn.shields@pacourts.us. I check my email all the time. We've got our website, which is pa-interbranchcommission.com. You can reach out. You can sign up for our newsletter. Certainly follow us. We are phasing out our, I still call it Twitter, X account, but we are phasing that out because it's just not a great place for engagement. But those are ways that you can absolutely interact with us, and we look for that. We look to talk to people and hear what their experiences are like. Yeah, at the end of the day, I'm an attorney who's been practicing for more than 20 years. I understand how to navigate bureaucracy. I know how to navigate courts. That's not the experience of average citizens.
Right.
So we have to think about that and do a better job of making our systems accessible mm-hmm. to average citizens.
So when you go about your particular business then, what are some of the obstacles you face?
This time last year, we were in the midst of organizing a House Judiciary Committee hearing on jury services. And we focused on three things: jury compensation, jury mental health, and jury composition. Most people don't realize until they receive a summons to show up in court that right now we pay jurors $9 a day to show up, 20 some dollars a day if the trial goes more than 3 days. And the last time that figure changed was in the 1950s when the minimum wage was $1 an hour. So we know, right,
yeah,
that at the time we came up with the $9 per diem, that was meant to compensate you for a full day of work. We had the hearing. It was illuminating for a number of the members of the General Assembly that were there. But then there was no legislation,
mm-hmm.
which happens, right? It's not always a ripe time to tackle an issue. Well, at Interbranch Commission, we didn't just stop there. We said, okay, what other options are available to deal with the fact that it is a financial hardship for many to show up in court? Well, can we work with civic organizations about the concept of civic time off? The idea that if you work at a company, that they will allow you time off to serve really important civic functions like serving on a jury or perhaps helping people at a polling place. Can we, when we talk about juror mental health, develop a pamphlet that goes out to jurors after they've sat on a trial and talks to them about what vicarious trauma is and how to address it? That's what we did last year, and that's what we're beginning to roll out across all 67 counties, all 60 judicial districts. It's those sorts of things that we try to do. Certainly, we advocate. Ideally, we get legislative change, as we did with indigent defense funding, which is now happening in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was one of the last states to provide statewide funding for indigent defense. We do that advocacy with government officials, but we also try to be part of the solution by providing what support we can as a small organization. We find that there's a lot that we can do, and we have a lot of great ideas.
That's excellent. Once again, if you'd like to mention the website?
Absolutely. It's pa-interbranchcommission.com. You can always reach out to us via social media. We are on Facebook. We are on LinkedIn. We're on Instagram. Like, follow, share content, and share your concerns about what is and what isn't working.
Excellent.
That's what we're doing.
My guest has been Marilyn Shields, Executive Director with Pennsylvania Interbranch Commission for Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Fairness, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here.
You're listening to the LCHR Chronicles. Let's take a short break. Do stay tuned.
Thank you to the members of WDIY for making all the programming you hear possible. Becoming a WDIY member is the best way to support your listening and to ensure WDIY will be here for the next person in our community to discover. Make your membership gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 4 or wdiy.org. We couldn't be here without you.
Welcome back to the LCHR Chronicles. My second guest is Stephanie Wine, clean water and conservation advocate with Penn Environment Research and Policy Center. Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's been quite a lot of discussion in the Lehigh Valley over the past several months regarding lead, lead pipes, and of course, drinking water. I also know Penn Environment was in Bethlehem a few months ago, so could you give us an overview of the issue, any updates, and of course, Penn Environment's role?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So Penn Environment has been working on this issue of lead in school drinking water for years now. For our kids to stay healthy, they need to have access to safe, clean drinking water, especially in the very place they go to learn and grow. And a lot of parents are shocked to learn that there actually aren't strong laws governing water quality in our kids' schools. So we recently put out a report this fall, the one that you mentioned, that looked at some of the biggest school districts around the state and what they were doing to protect our children from lead in their school water. So we surveyed 9 school districts. Bethlehem was one of them, but it was also Altoona, Norristown, Westchester, Upper Darby, a few others, to look at if, one, they were complying with the best practices to protect kids from lead in drinking water, and if they were complying with what little law we do have here in Pennsylvania. And to take a step back, lead is a potent neurotoxin. It's unsafe at any level. And it's really common in not just our old buildings, but even any building built before 2014 might have lead in the pipes, in the solder, or the fittings. And lead is really different from other water contaminants. If you have a factory that pollutes in the local river, that's going to get taken out at the water treatment plant that provides water to our homes and our schools. But lead contamination actually happens in the building. And so the way to deal with it is either to remove the lead infrastructure or to get a lead certified filter where we're filling up our drinking water glass. So really, we have to think about it a little differently from other contaminants. But even at very low levels, it can cause pretty big impacts on brain development, on attention, behavioral issues, cognitive capacity. The American Academy of Pediatrics estimates something like 22 million IQ points lost across American children every year due to lead exposure. And there's an irony to kids getting exposed to the very place where they're supposed to be, you know, growing and developing their brains. So what we found was that in all 9 school districts we looked at, they were either not complying with the letter of the law or following the best practices in terms of keeping kids safe and healthy. So that includes things like regularly testing all the outlets that are used for cooking and drinking, disclosing that information to community members so that parents know what action school are taking, and reporting what they find to the Pennsylvania Department of Education.
So let me ask another question. You're working on this particular issue. We have a new administration on the national level. In 2023, President Biden had proposed, or the EPA proposed, a 10-year deadline for replacing lead pipes. Do you foresee any changes coming down with the new national administration?
We know that obviously a lot of environmental and public health rules proposed by the Biden administration are now under review. This isn't one that we've specifically seen singled out and lasered in on. Taking lead out of drinking water is something that we found, at least here in Pennsylvania, has broad bipartisan support. But one of the bills that we've been working on that would close the loopholes in state laws and protect our kids more fully in their schools has actually a lead Republican sponsor. And so hopefully this will be something that, you know, continues into the future. That rule by requiring lead service line replacement in the next 10 years for homes, there's also a lot of money in the bipartisan infrastructure bill that's been pushed out to states to do that work. That would be a huge step forward. It actually doesn't actually solve the problem of the schools that we're talking about. They actually weren't included. So that rule, while very good, one of our criticisms of it was, again, this school loophole. I'm hoping that because of the, you know, bipartisan will we've seen to solve some of these problems, this is something that we'll still be able to get done, even in this really difficult political time. And to get into what's wrong with our state law right now, I actually can understand why some of these school districts are so all over the map in terms of testing and disclosure of the lead. Our state law is very vague. It says that schools have to test outlets used for cooking and drinking, but they can get out of doing that by holding a meeting about it. So literally, you can just mention why you're not testing for lead at a school board meeting, and then that means you don't have to do the testing in the first place. The guidance for these schools are not very clear. It's not very strong. And so we actually are advocating for a different approach. And that's that bipartisan bill I mentioned in the last session. It was Senate Bill 989, sponsored by Republican Senator Robinson from Western Pennsylvania, and then Senators Art Haywood and John Cain from Southeastern Pennsylvania, who are Democrats. And that would have a different approach, which is filter first. So basically, we know there's so much lead in these schools that whenever we do the testing, we're really just seeing the tip of this toxic iceberg. And lead, the levels can fluctuate a lot depending on the temperature of the water, the pH of the water. So there's also a lot of false negatives. You can do a test, see no lead. The next day, you would have caught it. And so instead of doing this, you know, this piecemeal testing and then responding, instead, we should just install lead-certified filters at drinking fountains in schools older than 2014. And then, one, we know that that gets the kids to drink more water when they have these new nice filters. But then also, we're being proactive. We're getting ahead of the problem. They're not that expensive, and we have this enormous peace of mind that we're filtering out the lead wherever it is, and we're not missing anything. And so that's the approach that we're advocating for, that filter-first approach, and that legislation, we're likely going to see it reintroduced pretty soon this session, and we hope that we can get it done.
So what can our listeners do to assist you or, you know, to bring the issue forward to the legislature?
First, as Pennsylvanians, reaching out to their both senator and member of the state house, because there's versions of these bills in both chambers, saying that they want their senator and the representative to support bills to install lead-certified filters in all Pennsylvania schools. Last session, it was Senate Bill 989 and House Bill 2011. We're not sure what the numbers will be this year. Calling your representative and asking them to support these bipartisan proposals, their common sense solutions, that will go a really long way, just hearing that call from the people to get this done. And then if you're concerned about your own school district, about where your kid goes to school, reaching out to the district. We know that districts are more likely to be responsive when it's something that they're hearing again and again from parents. A lot of parents I talk to, they don't even know this is a problem. And then we also have a toolkit on our website, and people are welcome to reach out to Penn Environment for it, for some tips for parents who want to get involved, you know, until we have these big statewide solutions to get their local school district to be proactive. And we know it's possible. Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, the two biggest school systems in the state, they both have installed lead-certified filters in all drinking fountains. Pittsburgh's done it. Philly's in the process of finishing it. You know, and those are school districts with not a lot of spare money. They're big school districts with a lot of kids and really tight budgets. And our contention is if they're able to do it, every school district should be able to do it. And so I really, parents can certainly be the advocates here in terms of reaching out to their school district and asking what their plan is.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, this toolkit on your website, and that would be at penenvironment.org?
Yeah, you can look under our Get the Lead Out resources, and people are also welcome to contact Penn Environment through the contact form on our website.
Wonderful. Well, there's another topic of interest. I understand there's been movement on PFAS, otherwise known as forever chemicals. So again, can you provide a bit of background and what's happened since our last discussion, April of 2024?
Yeah, so while lead has been a threat to water quality for a very long time, something a lot of folks know a lot about, PFAS has been emerging as this new threat to water quality. Pennsylvania has been something of a canary in the coal mine. PFAS was found here and in such great quantity and with such big health impact sort of first. And then we realized, around the country that this actually was affecting a lot of communities. So PFAS is an acronym for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, which is a bit of a mouthful, which is why we call it PFAS. And we also call it forever chemicals. The reason being that they don't break down. PFAS are a class of thousands of chemicals commonly used. It's in two things, really. It's in firefighting foam because it's a very powerful flame retardant. And then it's also in a lot of consumer products to make them water resistant, durable, fire resistant, or slippery. Given that they don't break down, they now are persisting in our environment and in our bodies. They've been found in millions of Americans' drinking water. They're found in bodies of most people who are tested. And they're linked to a wide range of serious health problems, including kidney and liver disease, immune system suppression, birth defects, and a set of rare cancers. We're exposed in two ways. And so, like I mentioned, it's in a lot of consumer products at lower levels, things like nonstick pans, fire and stain-resistant couches and carpets. But then PFAS foam in firefighting foam is how it's getting into our water in big concentrations. And so if listeners have heard about the contamination at the Willow Grove Air Force Base in southeastern Pennsylvania on the Bucks-Montgomery County line, or Emmaus right in the Lehigh Valley at a firefighting training academy, then it sinks into the groundwater and then is showing up at really high levels in the water supply of these communities. There's no safe level of PFAS. It is harmful in the parts per trillion at vanishingly low levels. And it's something that until recently, there wasn't any guidances for municipal water authorities for testing for or removing PFAS. Fortunately, and after a lot of work in April, the Biden administration had come out with a new rule requiring that our municipal water authorities start testing and removing the most common PFAS. That is a rule that I also hope is able to, fully come into enforcement, even in the new administration. PFAS is, again, something that has a lot of bipartisan concern. The issue is, okay, we can start filtering it out of our water system, but we need to stop pushing it into our environment in the first place. And so there's 14 states now, I think, that have already banned PFAS in firefighting foam. There are safe alternatives that those states are using. We have new firefighting foams that are effective, that don't require PFAS. But in Pennsylvania, we still allow it to be used in fire response. We have been working with the Firefighters Union. We supported a bill last session, a bipartisan bill, again, that would have banned PFAS and firefighting foam, made Pennsylvania the 15th state. It actually passed through the Veterans Affairs Committee with almost unanimous support, with wide bipartisan support, but it was right at the end of session. And so now that's another thing that we're hoping is able to get more momentum and get across the finish line this year. We know that, one, getting PFAS out of firefighting foam is critical to protecting the health of our first responders. The most likely cause of death for firefighters now is cancer. So some of the representatives I work with, actually, like Representative Monroe from Warminster, himself a firefighter, has had two different types of cancer. This is really close to the hearts of the folks who are putting their lives on the line to keep us safe in the most fundamental way. And so, one, we need to do this for our firefighters. But then also, when we're spraying these chemicals uncontained into the environment when we're responding to a blaze, that's going to have a long-term impact on the water table in that area.
Absolutely. Well, my guest has been Stephanie Wine, clean water and conservation advocate with Penn Environment Research and Policy Center. And for additional information on the issues of lead and forever chemicals or other environment-related topics, you can visit the website at pennenvironment.org. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for your work on these issues, and I wish you and Penn Environment much progress.
Thank you so much again for having me. Always a good time.
This is Karen Elchar. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to WDIY, and we'll see you next time on the Elchar Chronicles.